We've been with you before on a podcast. You talked us through Love of the Loveless and all the things that you got going on. And we said, you know, oh, in a couple of weeks, maybe we'll try this. And we're about probably a year later.
Back later than never.
I mean, Ben's used to my timescale.
And we've come round to it. So this is your top 10 favourite tunes of all time. Or meaningful music and things that really resonate with you. Yeah?
The 10 of my best meaningful songs, whether they're my top 10 favourite songs of all time, that's a whole different ball game, really. But these are my 10 most memorable songs, I'd say.
We've got another year for that, then. We'll figure that out next year.
That's another project.
Okay, I'll get planning that now.
And for those listening, if you listen to the radio show as well, what you'll hear from the 1st of October onwards as well, Ben's going to be doing a meaningful track for us each week with a little intro as to why it's meaningful, which is going to expand your mind musically as well, because that will be a nice eclectic mix.
So we're going to start with Eels, PSU Rock My World, which is from the album Electroshock Blues, which is one of my all-time favourite albums, so I'm really buzzing that you pick this. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful.
So you put that Mr. E is one of your heroes. Where does that come from, that idea?
I just love the fact that what he's been through in life, when you consider, you know, the death of his father, his mother, his sister, was it his cousin or his nephew who died in the 9/11 Pentagon attack, and yet his outlook and approach to life, he has this really sardonic wit about it all. And a lot of people who've gone through what he's been through, they'd just be throwing in the towel, but I just love the fact that he just keeps on going. He writes really beautiful music. Yeah, he writes a lot of melancholy songs, but they're just so sincere and genuine. And I just love anybody who's brave enough to just be that honest. And I just love the fact, like I say, he's got that fine balance for me of humour and, you know, melancholy seriousness. And for that, I just think he's an absolute hero of mine.
I think that it's the first album that I've ever heard of that deals directly with death and grief so explicitly.
Yeah.
With Elizabeth on the Bathroom Floor and Cancer for the Cure and all those different songs off that album, they all are direct references to people he's lost, aren't they? And it was it all seemed to happen at once for him.
It did, and a lot of the songs from his sister's point of view, so it's interesting that he's put himself in his sister's frame of mind. And there's a lyric on there and it always sticks with me, and I only know about it because I read about it in his biography, Things Grandchildren Should Know. And there's a line that says, the doctor says, write down 100 times, I am okay, I am okay, I am okay, I'm not okay. And that's based on the actual note that he found of his sister's, who was actually told by the doctor to write 100 times, I am okay. And right at the end of this note, it said, I'm not okay. And it just really sticks with me. That really strikes me as just, you know, how much he was struggling.
Yeah, yeah. But the humour as well. There's always like a sardonic humour, you know? And I think you're correct. I mean, there's real black humour in there.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him live last week, funnily enough, and I've seen him live about 8 or 9 times now, and he always refers to the more melancholy songs as bummer rock, but I think it's beautiful. I love hearing those sad songs, but the fact that he can just call it bummer rock,
yeah,
but still start and sing it, it's just, yeah, it's quite the skill.
Yeah, and the Things the Grandchildren Should Know, the biography, I didn't know that existed, so I'm going to go and check that out. Thank you for that recommendation on your notes.
I read it all in one sitting.
Wow.
I was that to it, but yeah, it's brilliant. Again, he writes it with such honesty as well. He doesn't, you know, try and dress up his language to be fancy for a book. He just tells it as he would if he was sat down with a friend. So it's really, really, despite it being heavy in parts, it's a really easy read.
Yeah,
because of how he's written.
Would you say that's influenced how you write things and how honest you are?
I think so, yeah. Maybe like subconsciously, I think, yeah. Yeah, everything you listen to, whether you realise it or not, has an impact or an influence on what you do, be it music or writing or anything. So I've kind of grown up listening with Eels. Like I say, I was on board with the first album, which was in 96, so I would have been 12. So he's been with me since I was, you know, a little kid right up to now, and I'm 35 now, so he's been with me for 23 years. So yeah, obviously that influence is there, definitely.
You said it was the soundtrack to your time during secondary school. And I think we're you know, you, myself and Rob, we're probably a fairly similar age. And I can echo that. I think we were probably listening to this album at the same time, you know.
Yeah, and like I say, of all the Eels albums, it's probably his most darkest album because it is about death, it is about grief. And yet I'm going through secondary school listening to this album, but none of my other friends were listening to it. So it was kind of like my little thing that only I knew about this. It was like the greatest secret that I had from all my friends.
And the other
but yeah, it's, you know, it's a miserable album, and yet I just loved listening to it while I was at school. But I didn't like school, so that's probably why.
Now, that ties into where you listen to this the most, as you say, in the bit that people can read. And it was a nice, usual place, wasn't it, Ben?
Oh, yeah, so my last 2 years at school, I started skiving because I hated it. I mean, I hated it that much. I couldn't bear being there. And so what I had to do was I'd have to get up in the morning, and sometimes I'd get up after my mum, so it'd be easier. But a lot of the mornings, my mum would make sure I was out of bed and out of the house. So I'd go to the local park, which was just down the road, and I'd go and sit in a very secluded area because I didn't want my brother to see me on his way to college because he'd walk through the park. So at around 10 past nine, I'd make my way back home because I know that my mum would have been gone then catching the bus. And I get in the house and I lock the door behind me and I go upstairs and I go straight to my room. But I knew that I couldn't just get back into bed because my mum's husband used to come home from work at dinner time. And I had this paranoid notion that he's going to check my bedroom to see if I'm actually gone to school because my mum would have told him, make sure Ben's not in the house. So my bed used to have sliding doors underneath. So I had this idea of I'll just hide under bed. And I used to just slide the doors open, crawl under the bottom of my bed, slide the door shut, and then on my cassette Walkman I'd listen to Eels album, and that were my days of skiving. Yeah.
Days of skiving.
Yeah.
I like this thing you put at the end of your notes where you say, whenever I'm faced with troubles of the mind, weights of the heart, or woes of the soul, I always turn to the music of Eels for a pep talk, as there isn't an area he hasn't covered. I think it's great, isn't it? I mean, particularly this album for me. I love all the other albums, but this one particularly resonates. And I love the song "P.S. You Rock My World." I think it's kind of a bit. It's quite optimistic, isn't it?
Yeah, and I say again in my notes, and I'm just quoting what he's put in his book that he wanted to get at the end of an album. He calls it his blue sky song, and you know, he spent the last 50 minutes or so talking about death and grief, but it's time to look forward and look upwards, and this is that song that's basically saying, look, you've got to, you know, keep going on. But there is a lot of sadness in the lyrics as well, but it is that blue sky moment, and it's just beautiful. And thankfully, started playing it again live on this tour, so to hear it live as well, it was quite a special moment for me.
Well, that sounds brilliant. So let's listen to it.
careful man tries to dodge the bullets, while a happy man takes a walk.
Next up, Devo, Wiggly World.
Yes.
Now this is slightly different to Eels.
Just a bit, yeah, just a little bit, yeah.
Where did you find Devo? How did you get into Devo?
So it's my childhood. My dad put me onto Devo, and I've said this before. I think I might have mentioned it last time I was on your show, that I was really fortunate to have the childhood that I did with my dad in terms of my musical diet, because I was introduced to so many weird and wonderful bands because of my dad's collection. It was so eclectic, and in there was Devo, and me and my brother, who's 3 years older than me, we were obsessed by Devo. I mean, especially the album, this track, Soft Duty, Now for the Future. We were just absolutely in love with it, and my dad had two videos of Devo, and it was just the music videos they had on there and live footage. And me and my brother Andrew, we watched these videos religiously, and we used to improvise, pretend to be Devo when we used to like mess about and play around. And so we put a Devo album on and pretend to be Devo live, and then we'd argue over who would be the lead singer, Mark Mothersbaugh. But yeah, I don't know what it was. I just think they were so different, but I just found them so exciting, especially that album. It's a massive influential album on a lot of bands that came out years later. But yeah, Devo is all down to my dad for getting into Devo.
What about Wiggly World? Why is that one the one that jumped out at you?
So, like I say, me and my brother used to pretend to be Devo, and when they do Wiggly World live, they do this, it's like a choreographed moment where they used to wear these like yellow jumpsuits, if you will, and they used to do this like, it's really difficult to explain when you can't see me doing it, but they used to like crisscross the legs in time with the music during one of the moments of the song. And I just remember doing it as a kid, like just copying that moment of like crisscrossing my legs on the spot. And it was always my favourite song off the album as a kid. So that's why this song really brings back those strong memories of pretending to be Devo and my dad just laughing his head off at me and my brother.
And geek chic, that's the term, the association, isn't it, with that band? But you don't buy that.
Well, it rubs me up the wrong way, I think, because I remember a few years ago it was like the trend, the thing to be all geek chic, and people would wear glasses even though they weren't prescribed to wear glasses. It was just, oh, it's a geeky thing to wear glasses. And one of the things was, oh, you've got to like Devo if you're a geek, because the only song they knew was Whip It, which was one of the biggest songs. But Devo weren't, you know, they weren't acting, they weren't, you know, playing at being nerds or different or geeks. It was genuine. They were really those people. So yeah, it just annoys me when people use Devo to try and make themselves look cool and geeky. Yeah, that's my beef with that.
And the musicality of the band, though, and the time signatures and the arrangements of the tunes and all of the things, it's not your usual thing, is it? There's a lot of thought and effort put into that,
especially on this album. I think this album highlights that the most, the time signatures they were playing with and messing around with. I mean, there's a song on the album that's in 11/7, if I remember correctly, which is just remarkable. Yet you listen to it and it's just easy to listen to. But yeah, they were so tight musically, and when they played live, they played the songs even faster. And some of the songs on this album, they're pretty fast as it is. So to speed it up with those time signatures and to be that tight, you know, this is really, really, really great musicianship. So yeah, it's a really interesting album for that reason, for the experimentation that they were doing, and that blend of synths with this art rock, if you want to call it, or that horrible term math rock that sometimes comes about.
You managed to catch it live?
Years later, yeah. Me and my brother went to see them live, yeah. But they were old men at this point, and I remember when they came on stage, they came on with Zimmer Frames, because even they, you know, they were in on the joke that, yeah, we shouldn't be doing this, we're too old to be rocking out like this. But yeah, me and my brother went, and it was a special moment because, as I say, when we were kids, we used to pretend to be them, and then there we are, 20-odd years later, actually get to see them live for real. And yeah, it was an epic, epic moment for us both.
So let's have a crack at Wiggly World. Brian Eno. What's your thing with Brian Eno? Because I don't know if I get Brian Eno, I'll be honest.
I know where you're coming from, because he's done a lot, and a lot of his late stuff, it's very light, really ambient, to the point where it's a bit too safe even for me. Brian Eno, early on in his career, very interesting. He produced the first Devo album. So his early stuff's really, really interesting, and his music for airports and his piano pieces in particular, I think, are really beautiful. But this piece of music, The Big Ship, yeah, it's a massive, massive song for me. It's really important to me, because I used it in my show, Love the Loveless. But yeah, Brian Eno, just early on in his career, I really do recommend you check it out.
When you use this music, was it something that you went looking for, or is it something that you're already aware of?
I was always aware of it, but it's just one of those songs you kind of forget about it. It was the part of the show I used it at was at the end, where I deliver this speech about basically like a conclusion to the show, if you will, and my thoughts on love and why it's important and why we chase it. And I always had this idea in my head, even before I started writing, that it's going to end with clips from films that represent parts that I've talked about in the show, and while it's happening, the lights will be changing colours. And originally I wanted to use a piece of music by Jan Tiersen, which is from the Goodbye Lenin soundtrack. But then I watched the film Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, and there's a scene in there where he's showing the Dying Girl, the film that he's made for her. And the piece of music they use is The Big Ship by Brian Eno. And it just fell into place for me right there and then. I mean, you could argue that I've ripped off that scene for the finale of my show. But it just fits so well, because it's, despite it being a really melancholic piece of music, I just find something about it really uplifting and hopeful about it as well. It's a really warm song to me, and it just was so apt, and it just tied everything together at the end of the show that I talked about, because it's not just a comedy show. It's, you know, it's very serious. It's about love, it's about the heartbreak, it's about the hope, and I just think this song represented everything perfectly that I did in the show.
Yeah, I think, having watched the show, I'd agree with you. With that context to it, it transformed not just the show, but the show transformed the music, because I listened to this again the other day, and independently on its own, if I hadn't got that touchstone, I don't think I would have had quite the same reaction to the music, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, funnily enough, for me, people who've seen the show, some people have actually cried at that end bit, and that's, you know, really overwhelming and humbling. And I always put that down to this piece of music that's set off, that's triggered that emotion for them to cry, I think. So it's just an amalgamation of everything. But even before I wrote the show, this piece of music always really struck a chord with me. But I knew that it had to be a special piece of music even before I'd written that speech. I knew that the ending has to have a really powerful piece of music, and I just think this fit the bill perfectly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's have a listen to Big Ship then. Yeah, so you and Rob went to uni together, but you hated uni, Ben.
Well, it's not because Rob was there. Let's make that clear. I didn't actually go to uni with Rob. He was around uni at the same time as me. But yeah, I hated university. I absolutely hated it. Like, the worst 3 years I've been through. I didn't think it could get worse in school, but somehow I went to university and it's like, yeah, I've outdone myself here. We've just how rubbish my time here is.
But you did well.
I did all right. I mean, I came close to throwing the towel in, and I remember having a meeting with the head of department saying, look, I'm not having fun here. I don't enjoy it. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And then she said, well, you know, you're on for really good grades here. She told me what grades I was going to get. I was like, all right, well, I might as well just stick it out then, because I seem to be doing all right, regardless of me not enjoying it. So, yeah, I just stuck it out for that reason. But, yeah, I hated it, hated it. I only met two friends on the entire course. And I think that's a lot of that's down to the fact that I ended up insulting the entire course. So I kind of, you know, painted myself as the black sheep.
You gave some constructive feedback.
Well, I can tell you the story if you want. It's because I did a film writing, filmmaking course, like a shown out of everyone's pieces of films. So I went to the first one, as you do, and every time they show the films, people just want to talk about their own films and get feedback on what you thought about their films. And it just made me feel uncomfortable and really cringeworthy, because it was just a backslapping session for 2 hours and I didn't like it. So when the second one came round, I told my friend, one of the two friends that I made, she asked me, she said, are you going to the film showing tonight? And I said, nah, I'm not going. And she said, if you don't mind me asking, why not go? I said, I don't like it because they're all just after an ego trip. They're not interested. And then, thinking that my friend knew my humour and understood me well, I then said, and you can quote me on that. So at the night of this film showing, and then they asked my friend, why's Ben not here? And she just said, oh, he says you're a bunch of ego shippers who like kissing arse. Then that was it. They were out for blood. And one woman said, he's so arrogant. He's so ignorant. Who does he think he is? When I see him again, I'm going to have serious words with him. Serious words. So yeah, that spread around the entire course, and yeah, I wasn't very well liked for the rest of the course, but hey ho, I stand by my verdict of, you know, those sessions being for ego trippers.
But it seemed like these two friends that you made there, like when you were at uni, that you've sort of shared almost like a downness, a self-deprecation, a shyness and things like that. And you said that these people you met also both suffered from a depression. So there was almost like a collective gloom around you, if I've got the idea of where you were at, right?
You pinch it in the nail on the head. I mean, you know, I wasn't in a good place in my headspace. And one of my friends, she picked up on how shy I was. Because when I was at university, I suffered from crippling shyness. I mean, I was so shy, painfully shy, and I had a lot of insecurities. And she definitely picked up on that and probably took pity on me. And that's why she struck up a friendship where the other friend I made, we were forced to work together. And from that, the friendship blossomed. And so we had a lot in common with regards to music, and we're both massive fans of Pixies. But yeah, while I was at university, I was introduced to Broken Social Scene, and they were a massive, massive part of getting me through that torrid time while I was there.
And the track that you've chosen, KC Accidental, is from the You've Forgotten People album. How did you kind of discover that album?
Well, this album's my favourite album of all time, hands down. It's in a long-winded roundabout way. My brother introduced me to a guy called Chilly Gonzalez, and we went to see Chilly Gonzalez live. And on this tour, he was performing with Feist. And at this point, Feist was completely unknown, hadn't put anything out. And I just remember the name Feist. I thought, oh, check out if she's got any stuff out when I get home. And then one night on Radio 2 of all stations, it played a Feist track. And I thought, oh, she's got an album out. I'll go and buy the Feist album. And I told my brother about it. He bought the Feist album. Then he went off and researched Feist, and then one day he said, oh, she's in a band called Broken Social Scene, and you've got to check this album out. I think you'll really like it. And then he pressed play, and he wasn't wrong. From start to finish, I just sat there in pretty much silence, just blown away just by how amazingly wonderful and exciting the album is. And for me, KC Accidental, it's the real first proper track on the album, and it's a real marker for what you're going to get on the album.
And the production's faultless, and you put here the melodies are infectious, the twist and turn. It's a journey, isn't it? This album's a journey.
Yeah, and I'm always a bit reluctant to describe albums as journeys, because you always mistake that with, you know, prog rock, and you think, yes,
and yeah, the concept thing. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't mean that. I mean, like, things, you know, for me, like an album like Brand New, their latest album, Science Fiction. It takes you on a journey. It's not a concept album at all, but no, you're along for the ride, you know.
Yeah, and I love albums that do that, because that's what a proper album should be for me. It shouldn't just be a collection of great songs. It should be a collection of great songs that work together to form some sort of journey or experience for you when you press play. And this album is just perfect for that for me.
Well, let's experience it now.
Just reading your notes for that last track, Casey Accidental, and you've said here it explodes with such euphoric power, a real statement of intent, an uplifting and awakening track. And the next song we're going to be talking about, which is a Badly Drawn Boy track, The Shining, that's quite a contrast to that, isn't it, in the way that starts off?
Yeah, I mean, the polar opposites, really. This is much more of a gentle song, is this Badly Drawn Boy one. But very, very melodic and very infectious. But yeah, they're completely different contrasting emotions as well, I think, what they evoke from you as a listener.
When you heard Badly Drawn Boy for the first time, it wasn't for you, right? It was your brother who was into it.
Yeah, because Andrew was massively into Badly Drawn Boy when there was a lot of hype around EP1 and EP2. And then when the album dropped, it was like a big thing because there was so much anticipation on it. And I remember he played me Another Pearl on his Discman, and I just said, I'm just not feeling that. Just not really into it at all. And he's like, honestly, it's amazing. It's such a good album. Then, not so long after that, I heard Disillusion on the radio. And it's a real, like, 70s disco rock track almost. But I loved it. It's just a really, really nice song. And I thought, I need to check this album out, actually, because it's completely different to Another Pearl, is Disillusion. So the next time I saw Andrew, he played the album for me. And the opening song on the album is The Shining. And, yeah, I was just like, wow, how wrong was I first time round? This is just beautiful. It's a really, really beautiful album.
I think this is the first track I heard of his, and I think it was around the time when we were at uni. I think it was either you or Andrew who played it, when I was probably around your dad's, I think.
It was 2000 it came out, yeah.
Yeah, so that fits about right. And it was, I remember listening to this and just being blown away, because at that time I had a little beard and I had a little hat.
Yeah, and this thing with Badly Drawn Boy, or Damon Goff, as he's better known, is that was his image, the beanie hat and the beard. And, you know, I was only 16 at the time, so you're quite easily, you know, impressionable. And I saw that beanie hat and I thought, I need one of those. I want a beanie hat. And so I started wearing one just because of how much I loved this album and what he did with it. And, you know, we were just saying a minute ago about how albums take you on a journey. And this is another one. It just envelops you in this autumnal journey almost. And I find it a really vivid album as well, the imagery that it conjures in the mind.
I'm with you on autumnal. I get that, without a doubt. Yeah. And it was the Mercury Music Prize-winning album as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there was a huge hype around it. I remember I used to work in music retail when it came out. Something interesting you put here is the cassette Walkman, and I want to unpick that, because I think that the reason that maybe people of our age really go on a journey with albums is because we have them on while we're walking, and we can't skip tracks, and you haven't really got, unless you want to like spend time like properly rewinding and fast forwarding through songs, and then you've got to get, there's a lot of guesswork, you have to listen to the thing in full, don't you, or at least the side A, side B thing.
There's effort into it. And not listening to something, it's far easier to listen to it.
The great thing about the album Wildebeest as well is that a lot of the songs bleed into one another, so there's no real gaps in between the songs, so it just kind of flows. And every time I put it on in the morning on my cassette Walkman and I'd walk to college, I always arrived at college at the exact same part of the exact same song. But I just, for a good 2-3 months solid, I listened to this album and nothing else when walking to college. And I just associate that walk to college almost with this album.
Does it work the other way, so when the album comes on, you're walking to college in your head again? Does it have that impact?
It kind of does. It's one of those albums, if I hear this song, The Shining, I need to sit down and listen to the whole album. I can't just nitpick at this album. I have to listen to all of it, because for me, at the time when this album came out, as far as singer-songwriters go, there was nobody else doing what Badly Drawn Boy was doing. And I still stand by it being an original album, personally.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say about, you know, even during the intro, and it's all, you know, with what was around at the time, you were just coming out of Britpop and indie, and everything was guitars and keyboards and organs, and this guy comes in with, like, brass and that. And more kind of... Although the arrangements aren't necessarily traditional and classical, the instrumental choices are, and quite soundtracky in places, and atmosphere building, and that was totally different.
I'm sorry.
Someone been shot there. It's not like been shot.
I was trying to hold a cough for the last minute.
And there was just nothing like that going on at the time, at all.
No, I mean, the whole that using samples things, I know that. Again, going back to Eels, he did it on his first. And you're right there, Rob.
Oh, I've got a cold off somebody. I'm trying to not cough and not sneeze.
Oh dear. Have some Lemsy.
Yeah, sorry. Ruining actually good thoughts and good recording.
I can't remember what you were talking about.
Oh yeah, we're on about you know, using samples and sound effects on the album. You know, other people have done that, don't get me wrong, like Eels did it on his early albums, but I think it's just the way it all just pieces together, and you've got bits of folk, you could even say bits of hip hop on Body Rap, you know, bits of disco, and it just, it doesn't, nothing sounds out of place, it just all works together so well. I mean, and as a singer as well, he's not got the greatest of voices, but it just works with this album because he's got such a warm voice, and again, it's very honest. I don't know, it's just, there's something about this album that I just think it's such a beautiful album. Even the artwork, I like looking at the cover. I think it just reflects the album perfectly. Yeah, it's just a really special album.
Let's have a listen.
Thank you.
We're going to change the vibe up a little bit, so we're coming away from, I suppose, more, I don't know, acoustic and guitar and band-based music, and we're moving into Boards of Canada, which are a marked sort of different sound. What got you into Boards of Canada?
Again, it was my brother. He was a massive fan of them when the first album dropped. The EPs before it as well. The big EP was Twoism, and my brother was just well on board with it. So I just got into them through that, really. There's just something about, even though the electronics they use are quite dark and eerie, and the sounds create are quite eerie, there's just something really beautiful about it as well, and quite warm. And I like that juxtaposition that they've got of that eeriness but warmth as well. And I think it's timeless, some of their early stuff. I mean, it blows my mind that this is nearly 24 years old. It's remarkable.
That's crazy. Yeah. Quarter of a century ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it sounds like if it came out tomorrow, it still sounds, just as exciting and fresh now as it did when it first came out.
I think from your notes, the thing I'm really interested in exploring on this is the sort of synergy you feel that this has with Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, so when I first got into Boards of Canada, I was 19, so I was at university, and as I've already explained, wasn't a fun time for me. I hated it, and I wasn't in a good place emotionally. But when I wasn't at university and I was, spending time hanging out with my brother and his friends and my other friends, I was in a pretty good place, and I used to speak to Andrew a lot. We used to talk deep and be really open and honest with each other, and he had a good understanding of where my head was at the time, and he just said to me, you need to read this book, and he gave me a copy of Catcher in the Rye. And for whatever reason, while I was reading Catcher in the Rye, I used to listen to Boards of Canada, and it just fit perfectly for me. I read this book, and I know it's a massive, massive overused cliche that when you read Holden Caulfield you think that's me. But that's how I felt when I first read Catcher in the Rye, and I knew straight away why Andrew had given me this book to read and listen to Boards of Canada. It just kind of, that synergy works for me. It just works perfectly together. So every time I hear Boards of Canada, I'm just transported back to the first time I read Catcher in the Rye and that profound effect that it had on me, with music that's also quite profound as well.
Thank you.
LCD sound system, all my friends. Now, you're opening this with a strong case. This song is perfect. No arguments.
Yeah.
Discuss.
That's it. Nothing more to discuss. It's the perfect song. No arguments. Have a listen. No, I just love it because it's got that blend of kraut rock, so it's got a very noi feel to it with the drum beat. But it's also got echoes of New Order. But then you've got the brilliant lyrics of James Murphy, who's, you know, talking about being in that midlife place of, you know, not knowing who your friends are and wanting certain things to come back. And it's just how it builds and builds and builds, and then it just stops. And I just think it's perfect. The production on it is perfect. The lyrics are just perfect. And yeah, I just think, I generally do believe it to be the perfect song ever.
And that's despite the fact that you didn't like them when you first heard them.
Well, I didn't mind them first time I heard them. I heard Daft Punk is playing at my house, and I thought, yeah, it's all right, but not enough for me to catch my interest. And then the first album came out, and I remember a lot of people saying it's really disappointing. You know, they had so much potential, and they didn't deliver. But they only ever intended to be a 12-inch band. They just wanted to do a 12-inch single and then disappear. But then James Murphy got a bit excited, didn't he, and decided to do an album. So, yeah, but with the feedback of the first album not being that good, I never bothered to investigate it. And then this song came out from the second album, and it caught my ears. But for whatever reason, I never bought the album as much as... Like I say, this song's perfect, but it can't have been perfect enough because I didn't buy the album straight away.
So it's from Sound of Silver, isn't it?
It is, yes.
All-time top ten. You're pitching this high. It's your all-time top ten favourite albums.
Yeah, let's say, you know, at the intro of the show, you said these are my top ten songs of all time, which they're not. A lot of the albums would be in my top ten albums of all time.
Yeah.
Definitely this. It's... He's been solid as James Murphy with the LCD from Sound of Silver onwards. He's been really solid with his albums, but it's a great album. You know, the song after this, All My Friends, Us Versus Them, that's another one I could have picked quite easily, but there's just something about this song. There's an emotion to it that I get attached to, and there's lyrics in there that I absolutely adore. The lyric, I wouldn't trade one stupid decision for another 5 years of life. I just think it's a perfect analogy for life. The fact that, yeah, you know, we do make mistakes and we mess up a lot, but it doesn't matter because, you know, we learn from it and we keep going. So, yeah, it's just an incredible, incredible album for me. And also, before I got into LCD Sound System, I got massively into disco music. And I don't mean the crap like Bee Gees, you know, the obvious stuff, but the more like underground New York stuff, John Morales and Larry Levan. And that's where James Murphy's pulling from, and a lot of his influences that he's pulling from I'm massively into anyway, so I think he's got that perfect blend of all his influences, and he molds them together so well, and that's what I love about LCD Sound System.
And you managed to catch these live with...
I did, when I got into them, they'd split up, and I was gutted because I thought, I'm never going to see them live. And you can just well imagine how great they all are, because I've seen footage of them. They're incredibly tight, and the energy that goes into their shows. I mean, the musicians, the backing band, they must be absolutely exhausted at the end of the set because it's relentless. But luckily they got back together and we managed to get tickets, me, my sister, my girlfriend and my best friend. And my best friend loves LCD Sound System. James Murphy's his hero. So it was a really special moment for me to experience seeing them live. And when they played this song, to be stood with my best friend and my girlfriend and my sister, it was quite emotional as well. So it was a big deal for me to actually see them live with the right people. It was special.
I'm noticing a pattern here, and one of the big patterns is that a lot of your musical discoveries are through family and friends.
Yes.
And the next one, Frank Zappa's Dancing Fool, is through your dad, right?
Yeah, Frank Zappa's my dad's out-and-out hero. Like, he absolutely adores Frank Zappa. And the day Frank Zappa died, my dad sat in the what we call the front room, because it's the room in the front of the house where his music collection is, and he sat listening to Zappa all day, and he cried because he was so upset and devastated that his hero had left. But yeah, I grew up listening to Frank Zappa, and at such an early age, the things that Zappa was doing, obviously it went over my head, the actual musicianship and the humour. I was far too young to understand a lot of the jokes, and in many ways my dad really shouldn't be playing some of the stuff that Zappa was singing about at such a young age, because it was really inappropriate. But yeah, I used to just love listening to it, because some of the voice, when you're a kid and you're listening to Frank Zappa, it's the funny voices that I liked, and he'd do songs like this Dancing Fool that were just really catchy and melodic, and it wasn't all about, you know, guitar masturbation and all that stuff. So yeah, I've got great memories of listening to Frank Zappa with my dad when I was a kid, with me and my brother dancing like fools to this song.
Musicianship. I don't think we can talk about Frank Zappa, and in particular the Frank Zappa band, without talking about just the incredible musicians he had. He had involved. You know, I just think you have to be on another level, don't you, to be playing music with Frank Zappa?
Oh, definitely. And the thing is with Zappa, he did so many different things that not all of it's to my taste. I mean, I don't think anyone can like everything Frank Zappa did, because he did so many different things. And there's periods of Zappa that I can't stand. I mean, a lot of his 80s stuff, when he got into the whole guitar solos, I just bypassed that completely. The early 70s, when he was with Flo and Eddie, I'm not interested in that, the whole toilet humour thing. But there are moments, especially with Mothers of Invention, that, yeah, the musicianship, they were just something else. They were, you know, they were cut above everyone else that was around. And even now, when you listen to it, it's remarkable. It's exciting what they were doing. And the fact that Zappa got him playing these complicated songs that he wrote, that in itself is no mean feat.
But in himself, his own musicianship, you know, it is not the same thing as Prince. It's a totally different beast to Prince. But, you know, Prince was an incredible, phenomenal guitar player. And Frank Zappa also was an incredible, phenomenal, unreal guitar player. But that's not necessarily what you associate them with, you know, because they've got people in the band that do that as well. But he was an insanely good musician.
It's like Dave Grohl as a drummer.
Yeah, I mean, later on in his career, when he was doing the classical stuff, some of the arrangements that he was writing as well, and that's not easy for a lot of orchestras to play. And even when Zappa, you know, conducted the orchestras when he was well enough to do it, he was never 100% happy with how musicians play. So that's how high the bar was raised to, you know, to deliver Zappa's musicianship. But the fact that he was self-taught as well, that's the thing that blows me away the most. When you hear what he's doing and he was self-taught, yeah, he's really is something else, really was.
I think this for me is the same as some other stuff that I've had through my life since I've met you. Is this again was something I'd never really been in or really aware of Frank Zappa, and then listening to this list of music, it's made me go off and look at these bands and these songs, but particularly this one that just caught my imagination, because it is so catchy and it is so lively, and then to go and listen to some of the other stuff as well, it is all different, like you say. It's just, yeah, more music that you've led me towards listening again.
Yeah, and the thing as well I like about Zappa, and I can see why he's my dad's hero, is his humour. Again, very, you know, he was very satirical, but he was very rude as well. But just a great sense of humour, so funny. Even now, I can put on Zappa albums and I will just literally sit there laughing my head off at the things that he was singing about. Yeah, he's just that combination of brilliant songwriting, brilliant musicianship, very, very funny. But he also made valid points as well with what he was singing about. It was kind of like, you know, the South Park of music, if you will, what he was doing.
Let's have a listen.
Yeah. dancing, that's why I got this song. One of my legs is shorter than the other and both of my feet's too long. Of course, not right along with them, I got no natural rhythm, but I go dancing every night, hoping one day I might get it right. I'm a dancing fool. I jump out of my seat, but I can't compete, cause I'm a dancing fool. Dancing fool. The disco folks all dressed up like this fit to kill. I walk on in and see them there, gonna give them all a thrill. When they see me coming, they all steps aside. He has a fit while I commit my social suicide. I'm a dancing fool. Dancing fool. I'm a dancing fool. Dancing fool. The beat goes on and I'm so wrong.
Yowza, yowza, yowza. I got it all together now with my very own disco clothes. Hey, my shirt's half open to show you my chain and the spoon for up my nose. I am really something. That's what you'd probably say. So smoke your little smoke, drink your little drink, while I dance the night away. I'm a dancing fool. I'm a dancing fool. I'm a dancing fool. I'm a dancing fool. He's a dancing fool. I may be totally wrong, but I'm a wrong, but I'm a, I may be totally wrong, but I'm a fool, yeah.
Hey, darling, can I buy you a couple of drinks? Looking for Mr. Goodbar? Here he is.
Wait a minute, I've got it. You're an Italian.
You're Jewish?
Oh, love your nails. You must be a Libra. Your place or mine?
Yes.
So this next track, I think, is one of those tracks that everybody would have sung along to, everybody would have been aware of, especially like some of his other tracks that you talk about as well. But this one.
So, yeah, we're talking Rupert Holmes' Escape the Pina Colada song here. It's probably the only song people know, really, of Rupert Holmes. And he has done some other gems, I'm not going to lie. You know, check out him, check out Partners in Crime, check out Answering Machine. There's some belters in there. There really are.
I'm going to have to find the other two. I do know him.
Yeah.
And I do love that one about the cigarettes on the windowsill and all that. Yeah, so that's why I really like the Pina Colada song, because I think it's where we've talked before about journeys of albums being journeys. These songs tell a story.
Yeah.
And there's a really good story behind why this is one of your most memorable top 10.
Well, there's two stories really as to why this is in my top 10 songs for what you've asked. The first one is me and my brother, and I've talked about him a lot tonight, funnily enough, and I just met up with him today. I've not seen him in ages, so I'm feeling a bit emotional, guys. No, me and my brother, years ago, we had this idea for this stupid project where, in the song, it's about he sees an ad in the newspaper, in the Lonely Hearts column or whatever, And so me and my brother had this idea of, why don't we put the exact same ad in our local newspaper? And if somebody responds with the exact same response from the song, I'll go on a date with that person. And we never did it, but that was the idea. So I always think of that idea never being fulfilled when I hear this song. But the other story is, when I started working at the library, it's where I met my girlfriend. And during our breaks, we used to test each other on quizzes. And I'm not saying this now to show off, but I am really. But the reason we did these little tests was because I had an appearance coming up on Eggheads. And so she was, you know, preparing me for my appearance on Eggheads. In case you was wondering, we did win, and you can watch it. It's on YouTube, Series 19, Episode 42, Burnley is Babylon. That was our team name.
What was it called?
Burnley is Babylon. It was a song by Russ Abbott, and so we're calling ourselves Burnley is Babylon. So anyway, during our breaks and dinner time, we used to test each other on quizzes, and one of the answers was this song, Rupert Holmes' Escape the Pina Colada song, and we just used to start singing it to each other all the time. Then I got excited, you know, because I know a little bit about Rupert Holmes. I was sad enough to, you know, delve deeper into what he'd done musically. And I said, oh, have you heard his other stuff? Have you ever heard this? Have you ever heard that? She's like, no, I've not heard him. Because you want to check out him. And she asked me, what does it go like? And I just remember we were shelving books one day, and in the middle of the library, it's nice and quiet, and all you can hear me is belting out Him by Rupert Holmes to Kirsten, my girlfriend. So we used to sing Pina Colada song a lot. And then I remember one evening, we just sat at home watching telly, and I got a text off Curtis saying, I've just watched the video for Pina Colada's song. Oh my God, it's amazing. And we were just texting each other about the video. And this was before we were together. So when we were flirting via the Pina Colada song and our love for it. But I love the fact that now we are together, it's our song. Now, a lot of couples, when they have a song, it's always something a bit slushy or, you know, a bit sentimental, where ours is a song that it doesn't take itself seriously, and it reflects beautifully for our relationship. We don't take ourselves too seriously. I wouldn't say, you know, the song represents us, because it's a song about Rupert Holmes wanting to have an affair on his wife, and that's not something that's crossing my mind. But it's just the fact that it's, you know, doesn't take itself seriously. But also, I forgot to mention my write-up. Kirsty actually made me a voucher, and it says that I'm entitled to one pina colada, courtesy of her, and I've still got that voucher, so I've yet to cash it in.
I was tired of my lady, we'd been together too long, like a worn out recording of a favorite song. So while she lay there sleeping, I read the paper in bed, and in the personal columns there was this letter I read. If you like pina colada, we'll be right back.
I knew a smile in an instant. I knew the curve of her face. It was my own lovely lady. And she said, oh, it's you. Then we laughed for a moment. And I said, I never knew that you like piña coladas and getting caught in the rain and the feel of the ocean and the taste of champagne.
Ben's, you know, 10 meaningful music tracks, and we're on to our last one, and this is Weezer, The World Has Turned and Left Me Here. I first heard Weezer when they did it was Windows 95 had just come out. My dad had just bought a computer, and Weezer's Buddy Holly, because it had the Happy Days kind of thing going on with the video, and they had that and they shipped it, I think, with every Windows 95 machine, and you could just like double click it and watch the video. So that was my first introduction to Weezer, and then I think it was similar to you, wasn't it?
Yeah, we weren't we weren't lucky enough to afford a Windows 95. We started off at that point. Buddy Holly was everywhere, and I loved it. I mean, I love the song, I love the video, and my brother got the album, and we both loved the album, and it just felt like the first band that I discovered away from delving into my dad's music collection, and it felt like it was my band, and it's a great album. I mean, even now, I hold it up as one of their best albums. To be fair, they've only done 3 albums that I really like, and after that, it just gets worse and worse. You just wish they'd stop. But the Blue album that this is from, it just reminds me of my childhood, you know, of playing out with my friends on Friday nights at the park and coming back home listening to this album because I was obsessed with it. I loved it. So, yeah, it's a big album for me. Even now, every summer, I'll always dig out this album and listen to it because I just associate it with sunshine.
There's a couple of things you've said. You said autumnal for the Bad Drawing Boy one and you've done summer for this one. So, you know, that connection for you between music and people, but also music and kind of environment and climate and, you know, what's going on around you and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, every time it snows, I guarantee you I'll listen to Sigur Rós. I just think there's something really exciting listening to Sigur Rós when you're out in snow. But yeah, Weezer for me is my sunshine summer band.
And you've got a story around Pinkerton as well, which is their 1996 album.
Yeah, so because me and my brother were obsessed with Weezer when it came up to Christmas 96, Andrew had asked for the Pinkerton album, and the night my mum and her partner went out, me and my brother went to my mum's bedroom and we looked for our Christmas presents, and we looked specifically for the CD shaped present, and when we found it, we carefully opened it, and it was there, Weezer's Pinkerton. And I remember we just sat in our bedroom listening to Pinkerton with massive grins on our faces because we couldn't wait till Christmas Day to open it. We had to hear it now. So yeah, every time I hear Weezer, I'm reminded of, you know, just being naughty, opening our presents, listening to Pinkerton. And my mum never knew we did that. She still doesn't know to this day.
She does now, mate.
She does now. I will be tagging Linda when we say that this is available.
So did you wrap it back up and put it back in the box?
We did. We probably wrapped it up really badly, like, but yeah, we shoved it back in there and then, you know, feigned surprise on Christmas Day when we opened it.
So what is it about The World Has Turned and Left Me Here from Blue that pipped a track off Pinkerton for you then for this choice?
For me, Blue album just about edges it as an album to Pinkerton, and I love Pinkerton. I mean, the opening two tracks on Pinkerton, I could have picked those, really. They're those. No, you're opening an album with Tired of Sex and Get You. That's why these boys are really raising the game. But Blue album, because it's Weezer's first album, it's my introduction into Weezer, and it opened that world for me. This song, my favourite song used to be Only in Dreams, which is probably a lot of Weezer's fans' favourite song on the album, but The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, it's strange really, because it doesn't go anywhere as a song. It just kind of chugs along doing the same thing over and over again. But for whatever reason, I just find it absorbing, and I just love listening to it. And I never knew, for years, I never knew that it was actually part two to the song prior to it, No One Else. So I never knew that until, you know, quite recently. So it makes it even more exciting for me. It gives it a new perspective when I listen to it. But it's pretty obvious when you listen to it lyrically that it is part two to that song. Oh, I didn't realise, I've no idea. But yeah, I just really, really like the song. It's simple, but yet it's just the guitar sound that they had, the production they had. It was nice, and, you know, sadly the producer, Rick, can't remember his surname, from Cars, died quite recently, so quite poignant really that you're finishing with this one.
Before you.
So, Ben, this has been your top 10 meaningful music, or not necessarily top, but 10 meaningful tracks to you. It's been wicked hearing your stories, hasn't it?
It's great to hear things that, from my perspective, I was around for some of these things. Other things have been, happened since or happened before, and it's always great to talk to a friend anyway, but to hear more about them and learn more about their perspective on things that they love is always good.
So it's good to connect with people through music, and it's interesting. You know, I've never actually physically met you, but I feel like through exploring music together and exploring your ideas, it feels like we kind of know each other a bit better. You know,
yeah, that's what I love about music, because it's such a universal language that, you know, you can communicate and connect with anybody just through a piece of music, and that's why it's so important for me. A friend of mine once said, without music, I'd string myself up. And as depressing as it sounds, I completely agree.
let's leave it there then.
On that happy, happy note. So if you have been listening to this, there is also the notes that we were referring to. We'll be posting them on the website, so you can read through those as you listen to the track listing. And we'll also share the Spotify playlist, so you can listen to that independently of the podcast as well later on as well.
Should we get pulled up on not being allowed to play the recorded music for whatever reason, we will make sure that we put the Spotify playlist embedded into the podcast, so that you get to listen to the thing, pause it, and then listen to your tunes on Spotify or whatever you want to listen to. So we'll do that as well. And do catch the Circularity Music Show on Derby Sound Radio.
You can listen on the website derbysound.org.uk. You can go in via the TuneIn app, or you can catch the show on Mixcloud if you search for the Circularity Music Show. And you'll be hearing a lot more of Ben on the show each week, doing a meaningful track each week with us.